Hey everyone, this is James Mackey and welcome to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. Join us as we cover high-level thought leadership and step-by-step guides on how to make people a competitive advantage for your organization. I'm incredibly proud to be the CEO of Secure Vision, the sponsor of this show and the number one contract recruiting, embedded recruiting, and RPO firm. A thank you to our partners, Greenhouse, the hiring operating system for people-first companies, and GEM, the all-in-one hiring solution recruiters love. Let's go! Hello! Welcome to Talent Acquisition Trends and Strategy. I am your host, James Mackey, and today we are joined by Corey Kozak. Corey, what's up, man?
Hey, James. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Yeah, I'm pumped to speak with you today. And for everybody tuning in, we got a good one for you. Corey and I are both CEOs in the tech industry, and we're going to be talking about the state of the employment market for startups and growth stage. What's going on specifically, you know, in the tech industry and demystifying what's happening in the market. We're going to be diving into hiring junior talent, hiring people with career that are going through a career transition, how to really know if your organization is really well positioned to hire entry-level talent, and how to help entry-level talent and career transitioners be successful within your org. We'll be diving into helping your hiring managers getting clear on what they really need versus what they think they need, which, as we all know, in talent acquisition, sometimes there is a gap there, right? And then we might also be diving in. I mean, since we're both CEOs, I wouldn't be surprised if we randomly start to discuss just different challenges and opportunities in building businesses, and as that pertains to people and what we're seeing on the market and talent acquisition and all that good stuff. So it's going to be a fun show. Corey, to kick us off here, before we dive into these topics, we want the high level overview on you. What you're doing with Aspireship. And so I want everybody tuning in to understand your perspective and point of impact on the topics we're discussing.
Awesome. Yeah. So Aspireship is an upskilling platform currently targeted at sales and customer success. We help early career professionals transition into the field, and once they're in, become successful in their roles, while also helping companies attract and hire really awesome, ambitious talent.
I love it. Okay, cool. So jumping into it, state of the employment market for startups and growth stage. What the hell is going on from your perspective? I'm excited to learn from you what you're seeing in Q1 as it pertains to talent acquisition and people. And maybe we could give some benchmarking in terms of what we were seeing in Q3 and Q4. What are you seeing out there in the labor market? What stands out to you with your client base, demand, what companies are looking for, how hiring plans have shifted, any of those, all of those? What are you seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think first it's important to give a little context leading up to this. What we were seeing in Q1, Q2 last year was tremendous growth across the board. Everyone was growing, still hiring, all of that. And the key thing that changed was the Federal Reserve deciding to raise interest rates really quickly in response to inflation getting out of control. And as soon as that happened, and I learned more about economics and stuff like that than I ever thought I would in this last year, because as soon as that happened, things turned dramatically. And Q3 started to dip, freezing of hiring, layoffs starting, all of that stuff. James, you and I were talking about this in Q2, I think last year, anticipating it, thinking it would be kind of a short-lived thing, but it actually just kept going. And so Q3 was the first like major slide. From my perspective, Q4 slid further. Layoffs were more aggressive. Now what we're seeing in Q1 is, yes, there's a bunch of big headline layoffs, like the Googles of the world and, you know, those type of companies that are, you know, creating a lot of attention. But I think I don't want to say it's the last wave of them. I'm sure there's going to be more. But a lot of the pain has already been experienced. And the biggest thing here, I think what this all comes back to is that the reason that there's such a issue surrounding this and why it affects growth companies so much is that a private company, like a venture capital backed company, they are funded by venture capital so that someday in an optimistic world, they become a public company and their stock gets traded on the public stock exchanges. And for that to happen, the company has to multiply in value from today and be worth a whole lot more so that public market investors will buy the stock at those values. When interest rates go up, valuations go down because the future value of the money isn't as great. And there's some other things, that are factors. But basically, if you think about why the public market matters so much, it's because if companies are funded today and investors are placing a $1 billion valuation on them, and 5 years from now, they grow like crazy, and they still might not be worth more than that. Just because of how the value has changed in the market. And so as soon as that happens, the whole plan of growing and all of that stuff kind of gets thrown out the window and has to be reevaluated. I think, I know this is a lot of info, but the thing I would cap this off on is to say that the biggest thing that the public market needs is certainty around what's going to happen next. And that's inflation and interest rates. In the back half of last year, completely uncertain. No idea how far inflation would go, no idea how far interest rates are going to go. We are now at the point most people that know anything about this believe we're approaching certainty and that things are going to start getting better, not what they were before, but better. But that can change. And so that's basically kind of where we're at and what we're seeing.
That's all very relevant and very important for talent leaders to understand and to be able to communicate effectively with other members of the C-suite or with their CEO or chief people officer, whomever they're reporting up into. Because one of the, I think, biggest shortfalls that we see with, for instance, like a VP of talent acquisition is they may understand the hiring plan that's given to them from the other executives within the company, but maybe sometimes have a hard time tying back to the North Star metrics that need to be accomplished to the company and having that executive level conversation. And so I think it's very important for talent acquisition leaders to really understand what's happening within the greater economy, how it impacts their employer's ability to hit North Star metrics, and to be more so a strategic partner in terms of focusing on business outcomes and working back down, cascading back down into individual hiring plans. So this is all very relevant. And I think one of the other things that I've really been learning over the past several months is understanding that what a lot of companies were considering scale last year really isn't scale at all. And I've been, I don't know if you follow Sam Jacobs on LinkedIn, but he posts a ton of content related to, what does scale really mean? And last year we saw companies raise money at crazy valuations, right? Well, I guess almost like the year before last, right? 2021. And I guess maybe Q1 of last year, we were still seeing that. But we're seeing, companies raise a ton of money and go out and hire a shit ton of people. And they're calling that scale. And really what that means is they've taken on debt or they've taken on large expenses, right? By hiring all of these employees, but they really didn't think about anything related to unit economics. And really what scale is scaling repeatable profitability. At least, maybe not in the short term, but okay, we're willing to sacrifice repeated profitability in the short term because we believe that we are not going to churn our customer base. And at some point we can flip a switch and turn this into a sustainable company that doesn't require investment cash flow in order to thrive. And so we see a lot of those companies now, struggling, right? Because they don't have any short-term path to any type of profitability. Some of which maybe never focused on unit economics and really don't have any path even long-term, but certainly a lot of these companies don't even have a path short-term. And so we're seeing, decreasing burn rates, obviously being a top priority. So I think it's definitely an interesting time to be in talent acquisition. What I will say is we have as an embedded recruiting provider, right? So we basically companies borrow recruiters from us. Our recruiters act like internal recruiters on demand. Some folks that are familiar with the space would call it RPO. But basically we already in Q1 have already closed more revenue than we closed all of Q3. So
yeah,
that being said, we are still experiencing high churn, right? Where companies are taking shorter term projects with us. It's more strategic, lower volume hiring plans. But we are seeing a lot more decisiveness, shorter sales cycles on our end, more closed revenue. I'm cautiously optimistic. The one thing that I do not know is the increase in hiring that we're seeing in Q1, is that a result of annual planning where companies have just decided, okay, we have to hire for these key positions. And as a result, is that going to be temporary, or is the market really starting to stabilize? And, you know, Corey, companies like ours can be an indicator of the market where we start to rebound 3 to 6 months before the greater market. Like in COVID conditions, people were still posting online about how bad the market was. Meanwhile, we were growing fast, right? So I'm curious to get your perspective on that. Are we seeing a temporary uptick first off, are you seeing that uptick? And then, yeah, you know, what do you think is going on and causing that?
Yeah. So January is good. And we seasonally, we expect like Q1 to be good. It always typically is. My belief is that the market is stabilizing. But like I said, last year was all about uncertainty, right? So uncertainty drove a lot of things to happen, including perhaps more layoffs than necessary, and other times perfectly necessary, right? But I think that right now there is a cautious optimism. But as soon as, like, let's say in a couple of weeks, there's an inflation report and it goes the opposite direction. Like, cross fingers and toes, that is not the case, because that will create paralysis in the market for an extended period of time. But barring those kind of surprises that happen that shake things up, people are cautiously optimistic again. And that means that things will very likely stabilize, and we will very likely turn into a modest growth kind of period, as opposed to, regardless of what's happening in the overall economy, recession, whatever, you know, as it pertains to talent acquisition, you remember this from COVID, everything froze. Layoffs happened and everything froze, and it pent up demand for later, which then created this crazy cycle of trying to play catch up. This will not be like that, because the amount of money flowing into the system is not going to come anywhere near what was flowing in at that time when interest rates came down and just massive money being poured in. But it's kind of funny, like you think about it, it's all about perspective, right? And if you expect everything to be awful and nobody to be hiring, and you're surprised when you see a job posted, then as soon as you see some like moderately positive news, you're like, wow, everything's great. It's like, well, it's just like halfway normal, right? And so we're getting more to that level. I think the panic is ending, and the money will start returning to the system just in much smaller quantities and focused at different levels. I don't want to go down too far down a rabbit hole, but if you want to talk about the difference between like earlier stage and growth stage, there's a lot to say about that with regards to this topic.
Well, sure. And I think in terms of a market recovery, we are seeing right now, well, in December, at least, which is the last stat that I have in inflation, it came in at 6.5%, which is down from, I think at its peak last year was in June.
9.1%
in June. So we have come down to a significant amount. And it's crazy. If you look at the 2021 stats, you know, we started the year at 1.4% and ended at 7% within a 12-month period. And that's, we were seeing this insane growth along the way. But, we're starting to come back down. There are a lot of people within the startup and growth stage, very, you know, prominent investors. I was on a call with Jason Limpkin. He was doing a kind of like a fireside chat, if you will, with a group of CEOs. And I was on that call with him last week, and he said, you know, things ultimately aren't that bad right now. quite honestly, Corey, our industry is probably getting hit a little harder. But you know, things overall in the greater startup community are not that bad right now. You know, what we're going to start to see going into Q3, Q4 is things are going to stabilize. We're going to start to see a little bit more growth. But one of Jason's core messages that he was giving on that call is that we have to adjust our perspective on what good looks like.
Yes.
We're not going to see, you know, 2021 return. That was insane growth. It wasn't sustainable. And now we're essentially right-sizing, right? We're, you know, a lot of companies are losing some of that top line valuations and everything else. And we're going to adjust to a more, hopefully, sustainable and consistent level of growth that's going to be slower. And, you know, his core message is like, you know, the growth bull market that we saw even in 2019, 18, and 2021, that's not coming back, at least for the foreseeable future. So I think we're going to start to see, you know, a lot more conversations, you know, tying back in talent acquisition, tying back hiring plans to what's actually sustainable from a budgeting perspective, right? You know, our goal in talent acquisition shouldn't just be to put butts in seat, but to communicate with the executive team the cost associated, not only when it comes to salaries, which, you know, you partner with the CFO on, but, you know, what's going to be the cost per hire per source? You know, what's going to be the cost of ideally breaking it down from an onboarding perspective, a management perspective, you know, and really understanding those cost structures and being a little bit more analytical and being able to get more within spreadsheets and being that type of strategic partner versus just being the talent acquisition leader saying, okay, you know, the CEO saying we're at 50 people this year, I got to be at 200 people in 12 months. What do we do? Right. Where it's just like this almost like overemphasis on top line growth at the expense of even considering unit economics or considering cost or anything else. So I think we're also going to start to see, you know, if for folks that want to be that senior VP or move into a CPO role, there's going to be a shift in skill set where people in talent acquisition is going to have to become more of an analytical motion. People are going to have to get deeper into understanding cost and sustainability. And that's my prediction for the next few years.
Yeah, I love that you said that because it brought up a thought, that something that's been on my mind for a number of years. And that is that the disconnect between talent acquisition and talent retention, right? So in my experience, most people who are in the talent acquisition seat, the focus is on getting the butts in the seats, right? Getting people in the door. And yeah, they don't want them to churn out in 2 months, right? That's not going to look, that's not going to be favorable for them. But they're not as much measured on, like, did my person make it to a year? Like, did they make it multiple years? Like, are they building a career here? Or did they just take this temporary job and then move on to the next thing? And the reality for all of us is that things are going to be significantly better if you can attract people that are going to stick with the company and try and build a career there instead of it being a pit stop, and just get off the hamster wheel for a change, right? That's really what's going to breed sustainability. And so I think that if we can look at talent in that way and say, all right, like my job as a talent leader is to not only attract, but retain the people that are here and like plot a good career path for them at the company, that's going to lead to health in the company. If people see, like if CEOs see their talent leaders or their talent teams in that way, they're not going to cut them as easily when these things happen. Because right now, or like any other time where you see, you know, a market pullback, they say, well, I'm not going to be hiring a lot, so I don't need my talent team.
Yeah.
Right? I don't need my vendors, or I don't need whatever. And it's like, it's more than just hiring.
Yeah. What's interesting is, yeah, it's talent acquisition in a sustainable way. We're not just looking at this hyper growth from the perspective of headcount. We're looking more into retention. I'm not of the mind that, you know, people need to stay at a company 5 years for the company to be successful. I think if a company, a tech startup or growth stage is hitting, you know, a year and a half to 2 years tenure, I think that's fine. I always recommend you need to build your company so it can be successful with an average tenure of 1 year. But obviously the goal is beyond that. And I think it's like a balancing act of investing in retention and investing in talent acquisition, and also investing in process and technology and onboarding and enablement and these types of things so you can plug people in. I think it is a vulnerability if a company is too reliant on a few key folks, because if they leave, then it can set the company back. And the reality is the company should be much bigger than any individual employee, and we should be building in such a way where we can plug people in and out. But it's both. That doesn't mean that retention is, like, obviously we want folks to stay with us a longer period of time, but we need to build the organization in such a way where, you know, employees can turn into value creators faster, ramp faster, and we're not relying on a few key people. And I think,
I was just going to say, especially in junior talent, like if you're in sales, SDRs or kind of junior AEs, the industry's had a bit of a track record of doing things like 50% retention of these people. Like, hey, I'm going to hire 10 because only five are going to make it. We have to get better than that, or else like costs get out of control, lost revenue to the company is out of control. It's just not where you want to be.
No, it's terrible. And there's so much cost. And I think to some extent, I don't know how much of the total cost is really being reported accurately when it comes to employee churn and bad hires and just the sheer cost of onboarding somebody successfully within a company. And I think that this is actually a pretty good transition into hiring junior talent and career transitioners. As a talent acquisition expert, there's several occasions in which I find almost hiring for a junior level position more challenging than hiring for like a mid to senior level individual contributor role, because to me, it's a little bit more straightforward hiring, like for instance, a senior account executive, because there's a track record and I can ask about results. And if I can find somebody that's operated in a very similar environment, similar sales cycle, similar stage company, you know, great references, or maybe even my ability to back channel in a sense. You know, I can move within my own network to find folks. Junior talent is like this huge unknown. So like, I would love to just get your thoughts on hiring junior talent in general, or career transitioners, and how to, first off, how to know if hiring junior folks makes sense. Because again, like I think for earlier stage, right, sometimes I feel like hiring somebody with experience is actually a little less risky. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on how to determine as a talent leader, or maybe even like a VP of sales or, you know, customer success, how to know if it makes sense to actually hire junior level talent.
Yeah. So devil's in the details. But I think a lot of it comes down to how do we define these things? How do we define junior talent? Even what is junior? Junior to the industry, junior to the role, junior in overall work life experience, right? And so basically what I've observed, which drove me to, you know, found Aspireship a few years ago, is that the way in which, and I mean, this is like everyone, so it's not aimed at any particular, you know, talent acquisition persona or CEO persona or anything. This is just like the way it's done in business, is that we hire looking for lookalikes. Essentially, we have these cheat codes in our mind of, all right, if they have X years of experience doing this specific job or working with these types of customers or doing this type of sales cycle or on and on and on, whatever the cheat code is that helps us justify in our minds that we're making a good decision because hiring is really difficult. That's what we do. And everybody that doesn't fit whatever we think those things are, and those things are different to everybody, right? To some, it's you don't have SaaS experience, or you don't have experience in the education sector, or you haven't been in a closing sales role, or you haven't whatever, right? That is really, you know, the big thing that I see is just the largest opportunity in the world of work today is figuring out how to hire for capability, true capability, and not you were in this job before, selling to this type of customer before, and so on and so forth. And so to answer your question, when you think about hiring junior talent, it is not a good idea to hire junior talent, whether you define them as being like new to the workforce or just new to this industry or new to this role, if you do not have solid training and enablement capability at the company, right? If you are not philosophically committed to investing in people, then it is not a good idea. However, it is always a good idea to do those things, to have solid training, enablement, to really invest in people and really prepare them to win and understand why your company is going to win against competition and all of that kind of stuff. So you can't put somebody that lacks tremendous experience in this very, very specific thing into a broken engine. And I would say something that doesn't have a good onboarding or training process is a broken engine in terms of onboarding new people that can be productive, you know, rather quickly. But the other thing is really understand, I think this is where so many people struggle, is really understanding what, if I could strip away that I'm looking for X years of experience doing a very at a specific job title or serving a specific industry, if I could strip that away and I was no longer even able to determine if those things were true and I was interviewing, you know, a person, what am I actually looking for? What are the capabilities? What do they need to know how to do? I think that is the biggest thing, is getting talent teams and hiring managers to really understand what it is that they actually need and then figure out how they can assess people for that.
What stage typically do you see tech companies start to become successful at hiring people that are transitioning to a new career within tech, or a junior in that capacity, not necessarily right out of school? My mind jumps to growth stage, series, and honestly, maybe like series C. Series B, it's like that initial hiring push, but there's probably a lot of processes that are going to be changed a million times while they're figuring out how to scale effectively. What are you seeing out there? And I, maybe this gets into sort of like your ideal customer profile, right?
Sure. So my answer is going to be a little bit different than you'd expect, in that it's really not about stage. It's about mindset. So if you are a, you know, seed stage company or a bootstrapped company or whatever it is, not like huge, not, you know, off the wall growth or any of that kind of stuff. A lot of times you don't have the processes developed to really do this well, or I should say at the seed stage. Bootstrapped, they're a little bit more under control, I'd say, most of the time. And so oftentimes they have more, you know, things ironed out and they put more into each individual employee. But we've seen it work across the board. And then we've seen the series C's, series D's, publicly traded companies, even where it's like there's all kinds of problems because they're just throwing stuff at the wall and they're moving so fast, chasing numbers and whatever, that they're not doing the fundamentals properly. So to me, it really comes down to the desire to do it and the commitment. It's like, okay, we're going to take each hire seriously. We're going to invest in them and we're going to empower them to be successful. We are not okay with 50% churn. So a Series C company, at least in the, as Lemkin would call it, the go-go days, right? In the go-go days, a Series C company would be like, yeah, you know, well, we'll probably hire 100 reps this year and there'll be, you know, 50 left over, you know, when all is said and done. And that's perfectly fine by us. It's part of the machine. And a bootstrapped company is certainly not going to do that, right? They can't afford to do that. And so, yeah, it's much less about stage and more about mindset and commitment, to, you know, really doing it and building something that lasts.
That is interesting to me because my assumptions, which I'm glad I'm testing here with you, this is helpful, would be that even if an early stage company wanted to do this properly, they don't necessarily have enough resources in place to do so. And it's like, okay, if you're a VP of sales of an early stage company, how do you invest your time? And do you invest your time on onboarding, enablement, training? You know, to a certain extent, you of course need to do that. But then you're also investing probably into a lot of those executive conversations, helping define or redefine an ICP, going into budgeting motions on, you know, where the spend should be to acquire those customers, looking at client acquisition cost and lifetime value and churn rates and all these types of things. And so it's like, is hiring a candidate at that stage, at an early stage, we're talking seed series A, right? And I know you don't necessarily think about it that way, but just coming back to my assumption, which it sounds like is not necessarily, it's at a minimum, not the full picture, right? My thoughts would be though, that hiring somebody with experience would enable them to spend slightly relevant experience in terms of like, okay, this person's worked for, you know, sure, a tech company, or even as like an SDR, right? Or like a customer success rep. Like that means less time needs to be invested in their development. And so more time can be invested in those things that hopefully will enable the, I mean, everything, you know, enabling your people enables the company to scale too. So I get it. It's like both are incredibly important, but I'm just like, and that's where my head goes to, okay, later stage companies might have more bandwidth. But then again, it's like the go, go, go stage, as you said, where they're basically just sprinting and shit's falling apart. But as long as their key North Star metrics are being hit, they're not really focusing or doing anything else. So I don't even know what I'm asking at this point. I'm just further kind of testing that assumption of like, do early stage leaders really have the time to do this?
Yeah, I think so. Couple things. One is you also have to balance your perception of how much time is going to go into someone's development with the probability that you retain them at the company for a significant period of time.
That is important. I'm going to put that in the description of the episode.
So if you hire somebody that has quote unquote experience in this very specific thing, like they worked for, you know, the super common thing is you scoop somebody up from a competitor, right? Especially now in this market, like, oh, the layoffs happen and there's all these people laid off from these companies, and then their competitors that are still hiring are going to go hire all those people because they already know the market. They know this, know that, whatever. So yes, some might be good. Some might not be good, right? That's just part of reality. Not everybody who held a job somewhere for some period of time is actually good at their job or good people or any of that stuff. But the other thing is that let's say they do quote unquote hit the ground running, as everyone wants to see happen with their new hires. And you know, if we're talking about salespeople or whatever, you know, they start making sales and all that stuff. Well, if 6 months down the road or 8 months down the road, they're like, okay, like I got hit up by some other recruiter and the market's better now, and so I'm able to get this better offer and whatever, and I'm out. Well, how much time did you spend in recruiting and building up a book of business and doing all these things that now you have to do all over again, multiplied by however many people? And you can see the patterns in this of people who, I mean, it's kind of crazy. You can see some people who've worked for five companies that compete with one another, because it's really easy to stand out as like, this is a perfect fit because they worked for somebody else in our space, right? So I think all of this stuff points back to there are pros and cons to hiring senior people and hiring more junior people or people that are less experienced in your, you know, specific industry or the specific type of role. But I think your general assumption around stage is something that we had as well in the beginning. And probability wise is still true. A more mature company is going to be better positioned to support these types of people. However, we have seen a number of examples where we may have been concerned in the early stages of like, I don't know if they're really ready to take this on. And And then they did, and they had the right mindset from the beginning. And then now all of their people, I mean, we have some people that they started very early at their company, and now this is the way they hire. They just hire out of Aspireship, and right. they just keep going back to it because the process works for them, and they invest in making these people successful, and they're getting much better talent than they would get going out in the market and, you know, kind of taking whoever was interested in this, you know, early stage company.
I love it. And I would love to kind of nerd out for a minute and, sure. and just get more technical. I think it's like, it's also running some analysis on compensation in relation, the cost of compensation in relation to the cost of onboarding, learning and development, and trying to strike the right balance of, okay, if our comp is too low, for instance, then if we're spending all this money on L&D or onboarding, then, you know, somebody could jump faster to another company. But if our comp is too high, right, then, you know, that could also be problematic. And so I think to some extent, and tell me if I'm wrong, does some of this factor into the type of sale that the company is doing? So for instance, if it's like a low ARR, more transactional sales cycle, is there a correlation between that and hiring entry-level talent versus if it's a higher ARR number and the, as a result, since the deal is larger, they could almost invest more in that client acquisition cost and the SDR team, right? Or whatever else might play into that, where they can afford to do higher comp and more senior level folks. Is there a correlation there, or is it just kind of all over the place? I'm just curious to go into mind of like leaders yeah. and how they're making this decision to go like career transitioner versus like somebody who's a little bit more established within tech.
So I'd say it depends on the role. So like an SDR role could go across the spectrum because you could have somebody junior-ish, but just with the right level of sophistication, business acumen, you know, the way that they speak, all that stuff that can show well to an enterprise customer, which is effectively what you need if you're, you know, just trying to spin up meetings and prospecting and that sort of thing. For actual closers, like an AE role or something that's going to be more intimately involved in the conversation, it tends to go down market. So SMB, mid-market type sales, you know, for like a closing sales role or probably even for CSM, you're not going to go put somebody that's never done that specific thing before on like $1 million deal.
Yeah, you're not going to put them on enterprise. That's first of all, their head's going to explode.
Yeah.
And then also
it's just not the path, right? So in that way, it certainly matters. The affordability though, that doesn't change. the affordability doesn't change. Yes, like you can put more CAC into something that, you know, has longer lifetime value and all that stuff, but there isn't volume. So like on the SMB side, you have volume and you expect your salespeople to do more volume. And so it all kind of evens out. I think if anything, either way you slice it, if you are avoiding L&D, avoiding properly funding talent, whether it's through third-party resources or internally, if you're doing those things, you're just going to shoot yourself in the foot one way or the other. It's easy to say from our seat, right? Because we see this across so many companies. And of course, it's to our benefit for companies to invest in these things, right? But the reality is that you need balance. And just saying, hey, you know what? We're going to pay $5,000 or $10,000 more on comp, and therefore we'll get a higher quality, you know, person and keep them longer and whatever. There is always somebody willing to outbid you, always.
Yeah.
And good markets and bad. And if they're not today, they will be tomorrow. And if that's the only reason you're keeping people, it's not going to stick. And people, and there's been a bunch of studies about this, they value their own learning and development and future opportunity above everything else. And comp absolutely matters. It's high up on the list. But people believe that if they're learning and growing and there's a path to future, opportunity for them that the money is going to come. And if you're not providing that, the extra salary isn't going to make the difference.
And just to tune in on, there's always somebody willing to outbid. If you're running your company properly, then there should generally be somebody who's willing to outbid, unless you're like Google, right? Because if you think about it, there are companies within SaaS, particularly startup and growth stage, that are scaling unsustainably. And those are the companies that are going to have the worst valuation slashes and the hardest path to decreasing burn potentially, or going through the most excruciating layoffs as a result of that strategy. So I think when you're, of course, like there are some cases where your company might decide, okay, we're going to scale, we're going to be operating at a deficit, or excuse me, like a negative cash flow in order to scale the business. You know, I get that. But you know, if you're just solely going off comp, I think that's indicative of maybe issues with the strategic planning of the company and how the organization is running. And you're right. Like, people are willing to, I mean, comp has to be competitive. Like, you should have decent compensation in relation to the market, but you know, offering a more holistic package is going to enable you, like in a down market too, maybe not to cut into muscle and bone, right? Like, where you're cutting into your best folks as a result of over emphasizing base compensation or even variable comp to other benefits. And I think too, just like the career tracking aspect, which something is, you know, we haven't gotten too far into, but you know, showing, you know, clear promotion paths, right? Even if it's not, you know, huge changes in role descriptions, but giving people, you know, small level changes where they can have small increases in compensation or focus or scope are all things that, yes, it takes more time to develop, but it's one of those things, once you set it, it's there. It's not like not on an ongoing basis. If you have very clear metrics defined to what success looks like, once you set it up, it can be a great retention strategy as well, right?
Yeah, the last thing I'll add to this is that it's a huge culture bump to the company. You think about it from a talent acquisition or, you know, HR person's perspective. Everybody loves the idea of investing in each other and lifting people up, right? And if you're helping people within your company have a brighter future, like, that's a motivating thing, even when stuff sucks and, like, you know, sales aren't going well or like other things are happening that are really difficult. If you are invested in the people around you, it really makes a huge difference. And so I hope we can see a lot more of this, a lot more holistic thinking, and a little less absolutism when it comes to, you know, we can only hire people that meet this profile, or we cannot spend a penny on recruiting or a penny on our, you know, upskilling and learning and development because, you know, we're focused on profitability. It's like companies that are profitable and do well, they invest in these things because it makes the engine run better.
And I think that's, I mean, one of the core value adds of what you're building at Aspireship, right, is that you're taking on a lot of the, I don't know if burden's the right word, but you're taking on a lot of what's required in order to do this successfully, right? That's my understanding of your platform and solution, right? Like, you're doing a lot of this training. So it actually enables probably, I would assume, earlier stage companies to do this successfully versus if they were doing it all in-house, right?
Yeah, including not just the hiring part, but once they're in, actually having upskilling resources for ongoing learning and helping people, you know, navigate changes in their job and do better at their job and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's the idea. It's to be a platform to scale this instead of relying on people to just automatically know the answers, which is quite difficult to do.
I love it. And does Aspireship, or maybe there's other resources online, like, can you point our listener base to like resources if they want to learn more about how to help folks transition into tech or into roles for the first time? Is there any online resources that you could think of that they can research?
That's a great question. So I think in terms of the specific roles that we address, obviously we can we can be the number one resource for that with regards to first time in sales or first time in a tech company, first time in customer success, those sorts of things. In terms of the general stuff, there really isn't. There's some niche stuff. But my intention is really to scale this out to a lot of different types of jobs and be that, you know, kind of holistic resource. But you just gave me a great idea for some follow-on content we can do. Targeted.
I would love that. And I think a lot of
side of things. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, my man.
No, not at all. I was going to say, yeah, to help for the talent side and kind of leadership side of things and how to help people navigate, these new worlds, because ultimately it's not just about transitioning into tech. It is also that if you look at the last couple of years, look how much change we've gone through. You really think it's not going to keep changing? We got AI, you know, coming full force now and all that stuff. And so people's jobs are going to continue to change, and they're either going to change with you, where you get to hold on to good people and you help them change at the company, or they're going to change without you. And you're just going to be on this hiring hamster wheel trying to replace what you lost every 2 seconds.
Well said. And I think that that's a good place to end today. This has been packed with a lot of incredible value. I want to make sure that folks know how to contact you and Aspireship. So if they want to engage with you, what's the best way to do that? How can they get involved?
Sure. So Corey Cossack on LinkedIn or just go to aspireship.com.
Great. And for everybody tuning in, Corey's LinkedIn profile is going to be dropped into the description. And we can also put in Aspireship website, so you can just click directly through there. Corey, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I'm excited to come back for the 2024 edition.
Hey, yeah, come back whenever you want, man. This is cool. We got to talk about high level market stuff. And then we also got to nerd out with you a little bit and ask some pretty technical questions. So those are my favorite episodes. Like, we also do the ones like, what's happening at Twitter? I love, like, personally as a nerd at heart, I love getting like deep into operations and getting a little bit more analytical. So this was so much fun. So anyways, for everybody tuning in, thank you very much for joining us today. If you're getting value from the show, we'd really appreciate your reviews on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you're listening to this. And feel free to reach out to me, by the way, if you have any topics that you would like to see discussed on the show. I would love to get your thoughts on what we can do to bring more value to you and help you guide talent strategy at your company. So anyways, thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to the Breakthrough Hiring Show. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode and gained a lot of valuable insights to help guide your talent strategy. I also want to say thank you to my team at Secure Vision for making the show possible. Secure Vision is the number one embedded recruitment provider, and we are a 3-time category leader on G2. Secure Vision partners with over 150 companies to provide on-demand recruiters who specialize in either tech, revenue, or G&A. For more information, you can visit securevision.io. For more content, you can follow me on LinkedIn at James Mackey or on Twitter at James Mackey DMV. We've dropped links in the description. If you want to be on our show or have any topics you'd like for us to cover, reach out at breakthroughhiring.io. We really appreciate your support with reviews on Apple Podcasts. And lastly, make sure to tune in every Tuesday and Thursday for a new episode. See you next time.